Eric Sanchez here. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we are going to be talking about.
Questions are swirling here tonight about what caused the loss of one of the precious few F-16s this country has and one of the precious few pilots who can fly them.
Yeah, this is starting to look like the downing of a U.S. taxpayer paid for F-16 may have been friendly fire. And now because of it, heads are rolling in Ukraine. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. So let me begin with this, which is kind of what many observers of geopolitics and U.S. foreign relations like Jeffrey Sachs are going to tell you if you were to read them or talk to them. Our U.S. neocons in this country, for 30 years, essentially, they've been doing this, but they're literally pushing Russia and China, two countries that, by the way, did not get along. They used to not like each other. They're pushing them right into each other's loving arms. They really are. And the real matchmaker, at least right now in this moment, looking at it from a news standpoint, is Mongolia, interestingly enough. Look at this map. This is going to make all the sense in the world to you when I show you this map. See that right there? Look how Mongolia is perfectly positioned between Russia there to the north and China just below it. So what do you think Russia is going to be doing? Well, if you guessed that they're going to build a pipeline through Mongolia to provide China with 50 billion cubic meters of natural gas a year, you would be right. That pipeline, called the Power of Siberia 2, is part of Russia's strategy to try and make up for the loss of most of its gas sales in Europe since the start of the Ukraine war. So how do Russia and Mongolia seal this deal? Like this. So this is Russian President Vladimir Putin, as you can see right there. He's getting the red carpet treatment during an official state visit to Mongolia. And there in the capital of Ulaanbaatar, he met with Mongolian President Kuralsukh to do what is essentially, this is a business deal, right? Pomp and circumstance, children dancing. But this is really just a business deal between these two countries, which will bring together China, Mongolia, and Russia even more so than they already were. And who do we have to thank for that? Obviously, our country's foreign policy that seems designed to provoke China and Russia by treating them like doltish little stepchildren that are way beneath us. They're just bad people. Instead of talking to them and finding out if maybe they're not so bad, or maybe they are, but we need to figure each other out. No, no, no. Just hate, hate, hate. It's just... Anyway, to illustrate this point, listen to how the White House spokesperson minimizes the Putin visit. By the way, you may also notice that she doesn't even know how to pronounce the country that she's talking about. She calls Mongolia, well, here, take a listen.
Obviously, we're aware of the visit, of Putin's visit to Mongolia. And we've said this before, and I'll say it here, we don't believe any country should give Putin a platform.
Nobody should listen to him. Nobody should give him a platform. People in this world are no longer allowed to talk to each other. You know, you know what's funny about this? I'm bringing in Craig Pastapardula. I got that wrong. Jardula, thank you. I changed your last name. When I was growing up, we really hated Russia because it was the big bad Soviet Union. Back then, I remember as a kid admiring and watching Phil Donahue. He had Brezhnev on his show. Ted Koppel used to have Russian reporters and Chinese analysts. And there was, today, it's like you're not even allowed to say the name. It's like you could get in trouble nowadays for looking at Russia or China or Iran on a map. What happened?
I don't know what happened, but it seems that cancel culture has kind of seeped into our foreign policy. And, you know, kudos for the way you say those Mongolian names there, Rick.
She actually said Mongolia.
Yes.
And that's the spokesperson for the president of the United States.
Yes.
Castigating the rest of the world for being beneath us, not as smart, not as good, not as kind, but we can't even pronounce a word.
Yeah, it just shows you what our people in Congress, our people in the media, the people in the White House, what they actually know or don't know.
Both parties, yes. By the way. Both parties.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Because I think you'd have the same rhetoric if the Republicans were in Congress right now.
Yeah.
But I look at the situation, and I really honestly think to myself, I know this is all about economic ties. Anybody who looks at this, and you showed the map, you can see they want to get a pipeline going through Russia into China, make up some of those losses they had, you know, with the European market that went away with the Russian invasion.
It's a business deal.
Absolutely.
Are we capitalists? We hated Russia when they were communists. Now we hate them because they're capitalists, you know? I'm sorry, go on. This is the third time I've interrupted you. I'm going to stop.
No problem, Rick. I mean, I think this has a lot to do with our control, right? Mongolia is one of the members of the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
And the ICC has issued arrest warrants for Vladimir Putin for quite some time. This is the first ICC country, a representative of the ICC, he has actually visited. And I happen to think that, you know, the way Russia kind of combats what we do, this proxy war in Ukraine, is they kind of go make deals with our adversaries. First, Putin had gone to North Korea. We saw that. He went into Cuba.
Yeah, that was interesting. You know,
that was very, very interesting. Yeah. And he brought his whole cabinet with him.
You think he's kind of playing them?
Yeah.
You think
I definitely think he's playing.
Is that what this Putin guy is about? I mean, he's a player.
Well,
he's trying to, like...
I really think the Russians...
I can't figure...
The Russians are a little bit different, right? They don't just want to kind of muscle up back with military. They want to go in economically and make deals, the way they made deals in North Korea and whatnot, and now with Mongolia.
Yeah, it's a lot like the Belt and Road Initiative, and in many ways it goes against some of the status quo that we've seen perhaps before in the world, including what we have done in places like Latin America. But I got more for you on this, because there appears to be, and this is fascinating as well, there appears to be a shakeup now in the Ukraine government. The most significant being the resignation of the country's foreign minister. He is Dmytro Kuleba. He is one of, how'd I do?
You did very good.
He is one of some of those names, man. He is one of Ukraine's most recognizable faces on the international stage. And this guy just resigned. I mean, he's a top dog. He's the biggest fish up there, right? Well, this comes as the Russian military, as we all know, as you probably know, if you're watching a lot of independent media, has picked up the pace once again and is about to take Provolsk, the hub that is essentially sealing the deal on the Donbass for the Russians. It's also becoming apparent that Mr. Zelensky's gamble when he chose to divert thousands of troops across into the Russian border is not working so well. Might even be backfiring. That's not according to me. What do I know about military stuff, right? This is according to a lot of military experts. Like this retired colonel who just went on the show on The Hill.
I don't think this is a success on the Ukraine side at all. As a matter of fact, I think that time may prove that this hastened their potential military loss. And let me explain why. When you're talking about sending between 15 and 20,000 total soldiers into a country the size of Russia, there's literally no chance that that can have any kind of success because Russia just has too many resources, personnel, ammunition, air power, et cetera. And that is basically a dead man walking. It's not going to be too much longer before Russia is going to put this out.
By the way, I mean, I've been monitoring this. This is the same stuff you'll hear on BBC, CNN. There's a lot of Western analysts now who are saying this, saying they don't see how this could end up well for them. And no, the Russians did not take their troops from the Donbass and move them there. So... same old right now, right? But perhaps the most public setback and the most kind of embarrassing incident of late for Ukraine is the crash of a U.S. taxpayer-funded F-16. You know, like, I paid for this thing, right? And it's starting to look like the plane crash was simply a case of some type of incompetence. And what's the dead giveaway for that? The commander of the Ukraine Air Force was fired right after the crash. Listen.
The Friday night firing of the head of Ukraine's Air Force, Mykola Oleshchuk, comes the day after news broke of an F-16 pilot crashing. Moments after posting the dismissal, President Zelensky, in his evening address, said his country's military needs to be strengthened at the command level. Questions are swirling here tonight about what caused the loss of one of the precious few F-16s this country has and one of the precious few pilots who can fly them.
You know, when you put all this together, Craig, bringing you back into this conversation, it just, you know, some people might say, well, what is the situation? Because they get a lot of different information. Western media says Ukraine is killing them, you know, and other media will say, well, Russia's winning. And a lot of people feel like, well, what's the truth? Seems to me, trying to be objective about this, things do not look good right now for the Zelensky government, if nothing else. I mean, a lot of people are being fired. A lot of people are quitting. The F-16 incident, the Donbass situation where the Russians are about to take Provost, the situation in Kursk is really not working. Unless I'm getting this completely wrong, it doesn't look good.
Yeah. Well, I think you might be getting it a little bit wrong, because I think you have to define what winning and losing is. There's a hot war and there's an information war.
Yeah.
And as long as the money keeps flowing for this scandal over this pyramid scheme that seems to be funneling a lot of money back into the U.S. government, we saw the FTX scandal.
Yeah.
They win. So by going into Kursk, even though it was a dead man walking the situation, like you said, the Russians had to not commit any troops from the Donbass to go back. They're just using the troops they have over there, mm-hmm. and they're not allowing them to leave.
And by the way, what's interesting about that is it doesn't look at this point like the Russians are all excited about going in there and taking these guys out. They're still there.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you want to capture this much of a country yeah. this big? It's okay. We'll get to you.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems to be what they're saying. I mean, again, what do I know?
But no, you hit it on the nose, because they're breaking further into the front lines over by the Donbass.
Yeah.
So they're moving in. But the information war that the United States wants to have, so they can get more money flowing, they can throw up these headlines that the Ukrainians have got into Russian territory, and now all of a sudden maybe those checks will keep flowing.
You know, I've always thought that. Like, this is horrible, and I feel bad even saying this, because, man, I hope people really don't think like that. I've always thought there's got to be someone somewhere out there who, when they see you or me or some other Anderson Cooper or, you know, somebody on Fox or somebody report that a F-16 has just been down, they're like, yes, we get to build another one.
Yeah.
We get to build another one.
Yeah.
This is great. That's
yeah.
another $200 million or whatever. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, God, I'd hate to think that people are, that's really what this is all about. People making a lot of money on military hardware.
I think the proof is in the pudding. We've seen it for quite some time. You can hear people like Lindsey Graham, we'll fight to the last Russian. They don't care as long as that money flows.
Or the
is
last
flowing.
Ukrainian.
Yeah, the last Ukrainian. Not our troops, right? And they can sell that to the public. It's all Ukrainians.
Yeah.
We just got to fund them to stop Putin.
God, I would like to think that's not the case, but I'll tell you, it's hard to look at it that way, given what we're seeing right now. By the way, there is perhaps only one country in the world that is more obedient to Israel than the United States. That country is the UK, as you probably know. But now, for the very first time, we're seeing a kink in that armor. Listen to what the British Foreign Secretary just recently announced to Parliament.
I inform the House today, the assessment I have received leaves me unable to conclude anything other than that for certain UK arms exports to Israel, there does exist a clear risk that they might be used to commit or facilitate a serious violation of international humanitarian law.
So he's basically saying, we're not going to give you all of the stuff we promised you, because I think you might be committing some war crimes, according to, you know, the United Nations at all, right? It's not all the funding, by the way. They're only taking 30% or something like that, some figure. There's 355 systems, and they're denying them 30 of them or something like that. But it's a significant message that they're sending. And it seems obvious that if the UK is funding Israel's war, you would think they would have the right then. Hey, let me put it to you this way. If you come to me and you say, hey, Rick, I need some money. I'm going to start a business. And I give you, I don't know, whatever. I give you $50,000 to start your business. I have a right to call you once in a while and ask you how the hell you're using my money and what you're doing. And it seems like Israel is mad because the United States, and in this case the UK, how dare they tell us what to do with their money, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like simple?
It does seem simple, Rick, but I think the problem is that Israel controls our government. Half our members of Congress have dual citizenship with Israel, and what Israel says goes. This goes all the way back to the SS Liberty, you know, when Israel tried to sink one of our vessels, and they told us what they were going to do. Same thing that goes with England. I mean, look at Jeremy Corbyn. He couldn't say anything without his whole Congress attacking him, the Parliament attacking
him.
It's like
95% of the people who are politicians in the Congress and in the Senate are beholden to the Israeli lobby, and the Israeli lobby works at the behest of the Israeli government. So, by the way, isn't that interference? Isn't that election interference?
It should be. That's the real election interference. But Rick, you better be careful when you say these things.
I keep saying crazy things. I should be careful.
Well, you got to be careful, because they'll come for you.
And at this point, though, I mean, Israel is saying, look, we're not sure you're doing the right thing, and we're going to take back some of the money. It's kind of interesting. The U.S. isn't doing that, though.
No, not yet.
Nor will they.
No, I mean, you'll get some lip service from people in our Congress eventually, too, as well. But at the end of the day, those checks are going to come. We fund Israel more than we fund any country out there right now. That's where a lot of our money goes from our foreign policy. So same goes as Europe, all of Europe, France, England, all our allies.
Craig Pasta Jardula. Thanks, man. Good conversation. Appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to return to our focus of Ukraine, the latest on the battlefield, the F-16. You know, there's lots to talk about to try to understand this while taking both sides into consideration. Former Pentagon official Michael Maloof is going to join us in just a little bit. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
When all truths seem wrong, when all rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm going to be joined now by an expert in geopolitics in his own right. He's a former Pentagon official, Michael Maloof. He's been a frequent guest of our show, and he and I have gotten to know each other over the years, and he's good enough to join us now. So, Michael, I said a little while ago when I was speaking with Craig that, and I'm trying to be as much a neutral observer as I possibly can in a world where there appears to be very little neutrality, but that it does look like things are rolling downhill for the government of Zelensky or the Ukrainian government. When you start seeing people leaving the government, when you see people quitting, like the head of foreign affairs in a country, when you start seeing the commander of the Air Force be fired because a plane crashed, and when you see this situation that's developing in Kursk, which even our military officials, people like you, are saying objectively, that's not gonna work. You can't help but look at this and wonder what can be next for Ukraine, save an outpouring of weapons from the West, I guess. I don't know. How do you see it, Michael?
Well, I see it as this thing coming to a close very, very quickly. Huh. And I also see Russia now going to be intensifying his efforts to hit infrastructure inside of Ukraine, only to get Ukraine to finally stop its actions, its a little aggressions, if you will, because the war is over. It's been over for almost a year.
Really? You say it's been over for most of the year. There's nobody who watches any television in the United States or in any Western country who would agree with that or even understand how you can say something like that, because they've been watching all these reports telling them how well Ukraine was doing.
Well, it hasn't been, and the fact is that it hasn't been for quite some time. It's lost tremendous numbers of troops. Ammunition. It's war machine is not working. Its basic fundamental military doctrine hasn't been working against Russia, and a lot of that has to do with tactics, strategies, the fact that they didn't have air power.
Yeah.
air power, and they based a lot of their tactics on Western ways, which requires air power to protect the troops, to stop the tanks, to do away with the landmine. Well, Russia's had opportunity to lay these mines.
It's funny you said that, because I remember you're saying it sounds Western. Remember when we first went into Iraq and that big general from Tampa, what was his name? You know him. You probably worked for him. But he came out in his news conferences and he would always say, we control the theater through the air. We control the theater through the air. And as long as we have air superiority, we will take the Iraqis down and fast. And he was right. They essentially did. And I guess that's what you're saying that we were trying to do then, that we're trying to do now.
That's been the Western strategy.
Yeah. Schwarzkopf just came to my head. Sorry. General Schwarzkopf.
But yeah, that was during Desert Shield, Desert Storm.
Correct.
And we immediately had to establish air superiority. And once we had achieved that, and that did occur on my watch, everything was anticlimactic after that. It actually showed that Russian tanks that Iraq was using were obliterated. But that's not the case today.
Mm. So here's what I think you're kind of saying, and a lot of people may be saying. It seems like both sides, Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Putin's sides, are both trying to come up with the best scenario to get the best deal for when they finally come up with some kind of truce. I'm gonna try and improve my lot or my negotiating space by going into your space, says, I guess, Mr. Zelensky, by going into the Kursk Oblast. And Mr. Putin, on the other hand, is saying, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to go further and longer and harder into the Donbass, into Provolsk and places like that. So that in the end, if you say it's a month, maybe it's 2 months, maybe it's a year, I don't know. But at some point, they're going to come together and they're going to have to negotiate this thing. Who's going to be in a better position to negotiate?
They'd have to come ultimately to negotiate. This is what Mr. Putin is putting the pressure on Zelensky to do now. And he's going to be increasing his activities to hit more of the infrastructure. Now, Putin has other considerations. He doesn't want to appear to the outside world that he is trying to not only sweep through Ukraine and then take Europe or anything like that, but he also doesn't want to chase away countries that want to belong to the BRICS. And he's beginning to be quite successful now in bringing those countries in. And they see a stability on the part of Putin in the way that he's been handling things. He hasn't gone full bore in trying to wipe out the Ukrainians, the population entirely. It's just not happening. But he is going to be increasing going after military targets in order to bring this thing to a conclusion real fast, because we will be approaching winter here pretty soon, and Ukraine probably wouldn't be able to survive it.
Why? What makes winter so special? Explain to me. Is that a military thing?
Their energy resources in Ukraine will be absolutely crushed. It's hitting the infrastructure. Their electricity areas are being overtaken now, are being destroyed. So, and that's why, and they have very limited amounts compared to what Russia might.
Yeah, that's what you always hear.
The Ukrainians might be hitting some of the oil and gas resources in Russia. It doesn't compare to a few strikes into Ukraine.
Yeah, no, obviously, Russia is a bigger country with more people, a bigger army, more resources, sure, more everything, and Ukraine has to depend on the West to give them whatever they can give them. And a lot of Western countries are now saying, look, guys, I mean, we've given you all we can give you. We're done. We can't continue to give you stuff, which is a problem, which is a problem for them, obviously.
You're going to be seeing that now because we're approaching our own elections and people are fed up. And you hear Trump now saying, look, he's going to talk to Putin about trying to resolve this thing once and for all. He wants to sit down and talk to him, an approach totally different from the Biden-Harris administration.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's a fair point to make. I'm wondering, you were mentioning about the winter conditions for war. And since you know a lot about this, you're a military guy. What about terrain? Who has the advantage in winter? Or does either side have an advantage given that there might be snow on the ground or whatever happens in Ukraine in the winter?
Well, the ground will be hard and tanks can roll. Russia will have the advantage.
Why?
Ukraine has very few very few tanks in comparison. Plus, their logistical train to maintain these Western tanks is very much more sophisticated. And the production of tanks by Russia is, it's like five times of what, or maybe even more than what the Ukrainians have. So they're prepared to roll that out even more, and notwithstanding drones and what have you. And the Russians also have countermeasures for the Ukrainian drones now. So it's a losing proposition for the Ukrainians.
Final question, and we have about a minute. Do you think in the end this will all just come down to the Russian side saying, look, we got the Donbass, we're going to keep the Donbass. You promised that you're not going to join NATO and that the West is not going to be putting missiles next to us, and we're ready to sign a peace deal.
Well, they could have done that 2 years ago after Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. And then after the war actually started, they could have signed an agreement, which had been initialed by the respective negotiators on both sides.
But at the time, Ukraine had the promise of the West making them Superman.
That's right.
So
that's
now right. That's but not it, really there, I think.
That's over.
Yeah. So it's
that's
more.
That's over. And what you're going to be seeing now will be the Russians putting this increasing pressure. They realize we have an election coming up, and they're going to want to get this thing done with, I think, even before our own election.
It's fascinating. It's a great conversation, Michael. I'm so glad we had a chance to catch up. You're a smart guy. Thanks, Michael. God bless. See you later. That's our show.
Thank you.
Remember to always look outside your own box when you're looking for truths, because truths, look, they don't live in boxes. They're everywhere. The truth, that is. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.